Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. From Wondery.
How you doing tonight, Aaron?
Hey, I'm good, Justin. How are you doing?
I'm all right.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
If you're like me and refuse to let go of your skinny jeans, you're a millennial. And if you're a millennial, it's time to add Clarins Multi-Active Cream to your daily routine. Rooted in nature and innovated with science, Clarins has a long legacy of creating industry-first, plant-forward products. Using a skin charger complex made of 2% niacinamide and sea holly bioextract, Clarins Multi-Active Cream has been clinically proven to target the first visible signs of aging by smoothing lines and wrinkles, refining pores, evening tone and texture, and strengthening the skin's moisture barrier. While Multi-Active Cream can't bring back the golden age of boy bands, it can de-stress your skin. Clarins Multi-Active Cream is available online now. Go to clarins.com/truecrime and get Multi-Active Day and Night Cream for 10% off, a free welcome gift, plus free shipping on your first order. That's clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME. clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
So we've covered some disturbing cases lately, but tonight's case, a little different. Not that we haven't done wrongful convictions in the past, but this one kind of stings a little bit. So what are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Tonight we're talking about a case out of Tennessee, the case of Adam Brazil, who was accused of murdering a man by the name of Malcolm Burrows. This takes place January 7th, 2006 in Grundy County, Tennessee. It really starts off fairly simple. Malcolm Burrows is at home with his sister, and her son is also there. He's up in his room. Malcolm Burrows was 60. His sister Becky Hill was in her early 50s, and her son Kirk Braden was 33. But there's a knock at the door, and this is around 9 p.m. Some young man comes to the home, and Justin, this house is down kind of a desolate road, and most people, unless they're from the area, probably wouldn't even know there were houses down that way.
Exactly. Why you would go up to a stranger's house at 9 p.m., unless you really need help, I don't think I would do that in Tennessee myself. I would just try to call somebody for help, but you know, maybe it's 2006 and he doesn't have a cell phone yet. Who knows?
Well, and it is supposedly a situation where this young man needs help. He's saying that he's having car issues, that his vehicle is out of gas. Malcolm says, "I'll help you." And his sister says, "My vehicle's behind yours. You should take mine." She has a Chrysler. So he and this young man get in and they drive away just down the road a little bit, because that's where his car supposedly broke down.
Now, they're gone for a little bit. This young man returns to the house.
He returns and he tells Becky that Malcolm sent him back for starter fluid because it's the final thing that they need to get his car going. And he says that Malcolm said it was under the sink. So Becky, she goes and gets under the sink there, gets down on the ground looking for starter fluid. And that's when she starts getting struck in the head with possibly a hammer.
Yeah. So this stranger that came to the house is attacking her from behind as she bent down. Now it's believed that Malcolm seemed to have maybe a familiarity with this kid, but it wasn't really proven.
Yeah, we're going to get into that a little bit later after we talk about testimony. At this point, Becky, fearing for her life, because this feels like, you know, as we talked about in the past, there's a term homicidal blows.
Yeah.
That's what this feels like to her. So she starts calling for Kirk, her son, Kirk Braden. He shows up rather quickly and he gets a fire extinguisher thrown at him before this other young guy, this mysterious young guy, runs from the home.
Now, of course, they call the police, call 911, because this strange man has come into their house and attacked.
He ended up going next door to call the police because they didn't have a phone to call from at the house.
So this explains why maybe a stranger would walk up to the house to ask for help, because people don't have a lot of cell phones there. Maybe it's a complete dead zone. They're just using landlines more often.
A couple of officers end up showing up to the house. They arrive separately, of course. One of the officers actually sees a Chrysler by the side of the road, but doesn't stop. They go to the house because they're going to check and see what happened here, because the report is that Becky was attacked by some guy that showed up at the house. So
in this report, there's a lot of descriptions and statements given, one of which is her husband has left the house and the car is missing, the blue Chrysler. So the cops think, oh, well, we saw that on the road just a ways back, so we know where that missing car is. What else was stated?
Well, Becky said that her brother always had his wallet on him, and that at the time that he had went off with this young man, that he had $800 in his wallet that night. And she said about half or more of that money was hers because she gave it to him for what she called safekeeping.
Now her son says he was asleep, and that's when he heard his mom screaming and rushed down to her aid. He saw this young person hitting her in the head with some kind of object, and that's when they got into a tussle. That's when the intruder, young man, threw the fire extinguisher at him.
Yeah, Kirk said he did land one punch on him, and that will come up later because their suspect had a cut on his cheek. Now, Kirk said that when he went back in the home, he said he ended up finding a baseball bat that had been broken in a couple of pieces. It had Chicago White Sox engraved on it. This is apparently what his mother was beaten with. So the timeline here is essentially this young man showed up at Malcolm Burrow's residence, said he had car trouble, and he and Malcolm left in Becky's Chrysler. They were gone about 15 minutes before this young man came back and said, "I need the starter fluid." And when Becky got down under the sink to look for it, he started attacking her. That's essentially the timeline. The police are called after Becky's son goes next door and calls the police because they don't have a phone at the house. So he goes next door. The police are dispatched fairly quickly. And when they come out, they start taking statements. They want to know what happened. And they get this story about this young man that shows up. This is where things start to get really weird, though, because in the statement that is recorded by police with Becky, that's taken about 5 days after the crime, she's saying that this young man had been at the house earlier in the day.
So he came earlier in the day, came back, said he had car trouble, and then came back again and perpetrated the attack. But her initial statement was, "I'd never seen this person before." Got it.
It's very confusing. And this is one of the big problems with the case is, weren't these statements recorded by police? Don't we have a clear timeline? Don't we understand the players involved? Because as you look at these different statements, things are changing. Times seem to change a bit. And the fact that this guy was at the house there earlier, hours earlier, and then shows up that evening saying he has run out of gas. I mean, this isn't the kind of road you're just driving back and forth on all day. So is this not a concern? But either way, that's the story. The law enforcement officers are going with the story that's being given to them by Becky and her son, Kirk.
Now, the law enforcement that shows up, one of them is Sergeant Brown. And he's the main guy on the scene, correct?
Well, he's one of the officers that shows up. And this may be surprising, but even though this Chrysler is just down the road, no one actually discovers the body of Malcolm Burrows for like 2 hours and 20 or 30 minutes later.
They're taking the report of the attack. So why would any of them have reason to drive back down the road to this car that's been reported missing or stolen and find this body, right? That's weird.
Well, that was the whole point, was Malcolm left with this young guy, and then the young guy shows up without Malcolm and attacks Malcolm's sister. It's just very strange that it would take that long to find him, because he was maybe up to 9 feet away from the vehicle, and it appeared as though his head was nearly crushed. I mean, he was beaten to death.
So you would assume whoever perpetrated this crime would have blood on them, would have some sort of, they would have left some sort of mark or had something left on them themselves. And it was such a brutal crime, but not so much.
Yeah, and that's the weird thing is where is this blood at the house? You would think if this person had completely destroyed somebody and they were bloody, you would think that someone would have reported seeing the blood.
Well, when he came back, exactly. When he came back to the door and asked for the starter fluid, didn't raise any alarm bells. Maybe they just didn't see or look. But this one of the first sergeants on the scene was Mike Brown. Now remember that name, Mike Brown. He's taking a lot of the statements and doing a lot of the investigation here. But it was later, 2 hours, 2.5 hours later, that Sergeant Troy Brown would find Malcolm's body. So we have two officers with the last name Brown on the scene.
Of course, the police want to know, what did this guy look like that came to the door? Because if he was there 2 to 3 times the same day, obviously, they must have gotten a good look at him. Well, they learned that he was driving a gold vehicle.
They say it was a newer car in good condition, which that would make sense because a new car wouldn't have car problems unless you just ran out of gas. But we don't know what lies this perpetrator was telling.
Right. I mean, because we don't think this vehicle had run out of gas. This looked to be an attack. It was all a ruse. Kirk Braden gave a description of the person he saw. He said they had a medium build, short cropped red hair, that this person was wearing blue jeans, a white baseball cap, and a sweater. Based on this information, this is where there's kind of a bit of a mystery, because we don't know how they go from that description to the police going after a young man by the name of Adam Brazil. But what's said is that there was a snitch who said, I used to know someone with short red hair, and their name is Adam Brazil. So the police say, okay, they check into it. Well, he has a gold car. Of course, Adam's car is older, and it's got some dents in it. It kind of fits.
Yeah, you got a guy who semi-matches the description, and he drives a gold car. They're investigating. This is where the evidence is leading them.
Law enforcement goes over to Imogene's house, which is Adam's mother's house. Her name's Imogene Davis. And they want to inquire about a gold car. Well, she says it's her car. But she said, my son borrowed it because he's going to go to the mountain with a friend, and he's going to go four-wheeling and stuff. And so the police figure, okay, we've got a lead now. But Miss Davis is going to call her son and say, you know, the cops were here looking for you.
Yeah, it's scary stuff. It's the next day when they finally catch up with Adam, correct?
Well, the police had followed her to another residence and caught up with Adam there. And they asked Adam, hey, can we search this vehicle that you've been driving? And he said, sure. And when they search this vehicle, what do they find? They find a white baseball cap and a jacket. And so since they have his consent, they're going to take the car and these items back for testing.
And they're going to take a picture of Adam.
Here's the crazy thing. They towed the car and they'd actually tried to start it. It wouldn't start.
Which would fall in line with somebody asking for help on the side of the road, walking up to a house.
So was it a ruse or not? I mean, how did this turn into a violent attack or two?
Crazy people do crazy things every day. Now, with this photo, they create a photo lineup and put some other questionable individuals on this card. And then they go back to the family to see if they can ID this attacker.
Well, Kirk Braden is first, and he's actually shown one picture first. He doesn't actually see the lineup. He says that an officer showed him a picture and said, is this the guy? And he looks at it, and this is a picture of Adam Brazil, by the way, says, that's him. That's the guy that attacked my mom.
Then he's put in the photo lineup for the official identification.
Yeah, he is shown a lineup later and still picks out Adam Brazil. His mother, Becky Hill, she was pretty messed up from this attack. I mean, whoever attacked her was intending to kill her. And so it takes some days. And she was saying that she couldn't really remember anything after the attack, which is not uncommon. When you suffer a head injury like that, it can remove some memory. But she's shown the lineup. She ends up picking Adam Brazil out.
Now, they took that baseball bat and found a partial DNA profile on it, and it was a match for Mrs. Hill, not the perpetrator. There wasn't any blood found on the fire extinguisher, and there wasn't any blood or DNA found on Adam's baseball cap or jacket or his gloves or his tire tool or anything that could have been used in his car for beating somebody. But I think the baseball bat was probably the weapon.
And apparently nothing in the Chrysler matched to anyone. So forensically, they don't have a tie between Adam Brazil and these crimes. What they do have, though, you have Becky Hill and Kirk Braden choosing Adam's picture out of a photo lineup. Now, one of the things here, though, is that Adam had a cut on his cheek, and officers were really interested in this. They said, "How did you get that cut on your cheek, Adam?" And his reply was, "Well, I was at work and a box fell and cut my cheek." They don't believe that story.
Well, you have somebody that said they struck the attacker in the face. So it makes sense. But Adam, he's in his early 20s. He matches the description. He's been picked out of a photo lineup. Adam has zero criminal history except for a minor marijuana possession charge. He'd been married for 18 months and he worked at UPS as a driver, made decent money. It's weird.
But law enforcement really believes that Adam Brazil committed these crimes, murdered Malcolm Burrows, and then attempted to murder his sister, Malcolm's sister, Becky Hill.
And this makes sense with all the things we've just painted, with all the evidence we've just laid out. I guess a young guy wearing this baseball cap, blah, blah, blah. So I get it. It's still a little odd that there's no DNA, there's no fingerprints, there's nothing tying this guy to this crime scene.
But they have a motive. They say that Adam did this because he wanted money. And they claim they didn't find a wallet on Malcolm when they found his body.
So he attacked Malcolm, stole his wallet, and then returned to the house, attacked Becky to hopefully get more money and rob the place.
Or just to silence a witness, because maybe she could ID him. So tying up loose ends, maybe. But Adam had an alibi. He said, "Let me think. I was in a church parking lot talking to somebody. And then after that, I drove with a friend to the mountain."
So he's in a church parking lot talking to somebody and then with a friend. So he's got two alibi witnesses, at least.
Yeah, there's a very short window of time in there where maybe he could have gone over to the house and attacked these people and then went off. So, but it's a very short window of time. So, you know, where some people might say that doesn't seem like the window is wide enough for this, law enforcement decides they're going to go find the person he was talking to in the parking lot. You know, you want to get statements from possible witnesses. Can his alibi be backed up by someone that can verify it? Well, they track down this woman. Her name is Christy King. And they say, "Do you know where you were at such and such time on such and such date?" Which, of course, is January 7th, 2006, in the evening. And her answer is no. She can't really recall. And from what I understand, it's because she didn't really know Adam. She just ended up talking to him in the parking lot.
And when you're asked about a specific date, days, if not weeks afterwards, and you have no idea what the context is, yeah, there's nothing memorable that day.
So in their minds, Adam doesn't really have an alibi. In fact, that whole going to the mountain thing, suspicious now. And let's be honest, if they're looking for a guy with short cropped red hair, medium build, who's driving a gold colored car, well,
they got their man.
They're on that case. So they're just following the direction that they believe they need to go in, right? They have a trial and some interesting things take place. But what I really want to say is they have this trial and it seems as though the prosecution has the best evidence, which is the eyewitness testimony from Becky Hill and her son, Kirk Braden.
Well, I mean, they were the victims of the crime, so why wouldn't you believe them?
They're stating emphatically that Adam Brazil was the one that showed up to the house. That's powerful for the jury. They can point, like, "Do you see that individual in the courtroom today?" And it's like, "Yeah, he's right there." I don't know how the defense could have expected to beat that. Now, as time went on, and you and I have talked about this, and so have many other shows, but eyewitness identification can be very, very tricky. You wouldn't think it would be, but it bears out over time. They've proven that this is not as reliable as you think. But at this trial, it's everything.
But their statements about the night during trial shift from their statements given right after the crime, such as they didn't know him, whether or not he was at the house earlier that day, things like that. And the new car compared to an old car. It's little things. But still, I kind of believe the fresh witness testimony right after the crime is committed.
Adam Brazil maintained his innocence. Even after he was found guilty, he said, "I didn't do this." Of course, the plan was, we're going to file appeals. We'll get you out of here because you're not connected to this crime. They have nothing tying you to the crime except for the eyewitness testimony. August 2015, Circuit Court Judge Justin Angel granted an appeal. Adam's conviction was going to be overturned because, the judge said, the jury relied on the identifications from Hill and Braden, and the physical, the forensic evidence wasn't strong enough.
Well, let's just say it was non-existent.
Yeah, it wasn't there at all. They had nothing else tying him to the crime.
And it's not like these people had a previous relationship or connection to Adam. I think back to my jury duty experience, they had a past. So therefore, I believe the guy's eyewitness account. Whereas here, they're saying, we never saw this guy before. And then they're saying, oh, he was at the house earlier, but statements are changing.
There are some stories about my mom's life that I truly never get tired of hearing. Just in time for Mother's Day, I found the perfect gift that captures all her stories for my family forever. It's called Storyworth. Storyworth helps you preserve precious memories and stories from your mom or grandmother for years to come. Each week, Storyworth emails your loved one a thought-provoking question that you get to help pick. What was your favorite toy as a child? Or what's your favorite memory of your grandmother? All your loved one needs to do is respond to that email with a story. After a year of responses, Storyworth compiles your loved one's stories and photos into a beautiful keepsake hardcover book. You can even keep a copy of the book for yourself. My mom completed her story, and each of her kids now has a copy to read and share with their kids. Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift you'll cherish for years. Storyworth. Right now, save $10 on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/GenY. That's storyworth.com/GenY to save $10 on your first purchase.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
Adam thought, hey, I'm getting out of prison. December 25th, 2015, he's told, you're going home, Adam. Well,
he thought.
Yeah, that sounds amazing, right? But the Tennessee Court of Appeals would end up overturning that decision, and they would send Adam back to prison. He didn't get much time out, but man, you talk about thinking you're home. You're going to beat this because you had a judge saying there's not enough evidence here. The jury shouldn't have relied just on eyewitness testimony. It's like the circumstantial evidence thing. People are like, well, how are you going to convict someone just on circumstantial evidence? Well, eyewitness testimony, people think that was great. Well, again, it's proven to not be so reliable. I'd rather they were able to put a bunch of different pieces of evidence together to form a picture so we know what we're dealing with. But again, in this case, you have two people saying that's the guy and that's it.
Yeah. Well, something else that was interesting is they brought Sergeant Troy Brown onto the stand to question him about finding that body, as it says in all the court documents. I said, "What do you know about this case?" And he said, "Very little."
He said, "A little."
Oh. Well, the reason why he said a little was because I gave you some misinformation earlier. Troy hadn't found that body. Mike Brown had found the body, and Mike Brown had never been called to the stand to testify.
Well, actually, they told Mike Brown, "Don't bother coming to court. We don't need you."
Hmm. Because we have the wrong Sergeant Brown here to testify about nothing. Got it.
But there might be a reason for that, right? I mean, why would you not bring the guy in who was there?
We could just assume that they got him confused, right?
Let's talk about the stuff that they didn't do. According to Mike Brown, who would testify later, he said that when he found Malcolm Burrow's body, he checked it, and he found a wallet on him.
What? The wallet that was the entire motivation for this crime? Okay.
He also wrote up reports. But guess what? By the time this was going to trial, those reports, according to him, seemed to have been doctored.
He wrote the report, though. It's his report.
No, to tell you how confusing it was, someone actually went to go speak with him, and they were saying, they were calling him Troy Brown.
Huh.
And said, "You found the body." And he said, "No, I'm Mike Brown. I found the body." And they're like, "Wait, if you're Mike Brown, you didn't find the body." And like, "No, I did." It's very confusing because the reports changed, according to Mike Brown. See, this all happened later because after the trial, after this whole fiasco with letting Adam out and then bringing him back in, some things started coming to light, which really altered this whole case. Because up to that point, the prosecution, the law enforcement were very confident they had the right guy and they were not backing down. And the courts were backing them up anytime an appeal was filed. But what happened was they discovered that there was a fingerprint found on Malcolm Burrow's car, or at least the car from the residence, but it was never compared to anything. It just sat around until 2017.
Well, I'm sure that fingerprint was left by Adam, right?
Well, when they compared that print, they actually found that it matched a person with a good criminal record, Kermit Bryson, Kermit Eugene Bryson.
And what did Kermit Eugene Bryson look like?
Well, I always describe him as kind of a rougher version of Adam. But I don't think Adam likes that because Adam would tell you that that has nothing to do with the case.
Yeah, and that's part of the problem here. They have a similar look, although straight up, I could tell them apart. I don't think they look at all alike, but they both have red hair. They both have similar facial hair. They both have the same sort of style about them, I guess.
Their ears look almost identical. Yeah. I think if you had someone talking to a sketch artist and you had people, two different people describing each of these people, the sketches would look very similar.
True.
That's the best way I can describe it. You can find their pictures online and compare them for yourself. But I think if you just squint, they look very much alike.
So going off of these two guys look similar and the motive for the entire crime was a robbery. Now, given this crime happened regardless of the wallet being missing, but it was made into the entire motive during trial, yet the wallet was never stolen.
It was just not entered into evidence because Mike Brown said, "Hey, I handed it to these guys," meaning the sheriff and the other officers.
We talk about this all the time. If the prosecution gets their theory or their narrative wrong, it doesn't necessarily mean that the criminal or perpetrator did not commit the crime. But this is kind of a big deal. And if the wallet is their main motive for the crime when it wasn't even stolen, you can only imagine how many other missteps happened during this investigation and trial.
Also, Kermit Bryson drove a gold car that looked similar to Adam's. It was just newer.
Oh, it was newer, just like the witness testimonies. Got it.
So here's the thing. when you're looking for some kind of forensic or physical link between a suspect and the crime scene, well, they find Kermit's link. It's this fingerprint. And while Kermit was very familiar with one of Malcolm Burroughs's relatives, there was no reason for his fingerprint to be in that particular car, unless he was part of this crime.
And the rest of the family didn't know him very well, so they wouldn't have recognized him. But Malcolm might have, and that's why he acted somewhat familiar when he came to the door.
See, that's the thing is, if you live kind of out of the way, there's no real reason for someone's car to break down on your street, and they come to your door like that, you would think there'd be a little apprehension. You know, we have this from the testimony of Becky Hill. Well, Malcolm went right along with this young man, said, I'll help you out. And if you go by that statement that she had made, that he had been there earlier that day, it's like they're familiar with him. But why wasn't she able to give more information on what he was doing there? I mean, if he's the guy that attacked her, why did she make it seem like he was a stranger later if he'd already been to the house before? There's some things about Malcolm Burroughs that might shed some light on this. Malcolm Burroughs is a guy that had attempted to run for mayor. That didn't work out. He'd also served on the Tracy City Council. But he also had a reputation for some illegal activities, including drug dealing. And I believe it was prescription drug dealing. If you go by this website,
dksale.net,
he has a whole theory about why Malcolm Burroughs was actually murdered. And it has nothing to do with a robbery.
And it has nothing to do with Adam having car trouble and happening upon this house.
I don't really want to go into it. I think I'd rather DK Sale explained it in his own words on his own website. And you can go there and decide for yourself if you think that theory holds water. I'll say this. The theory the prosecution and law enforcement had did not hold water. And we know that because they ended up having to offer Adam Brazil a deal, a plea deal. Adam had said that he wouldn't accept any plea deal because he was innocent. And as this evidence started coming up showing that he wasn't involved, he felt more emboldened. Like, I don't need to have a plea deal.
Absolutely.
But here's the thing, is you can say, I know, I believe, I trust, I have faith. But if you have a prosecutor, the prosecutor, Steve Strain, looking at Adam is letting him know, this isn't going to end unless you take a plea deal, because they'll just take him back to court. They already got him convicted once. And of course, Adam's appeals never really went anywhere. You could say, hey, you have evidence now. Go ahead, fight for your freedom in court. Have your day in court. Prove your innocence. But here's the thing. Adam spent, what, like 12 years in prison?
Yeah.
How much is he willing to give up? He'd already lost his wife. She left because she couldn't handle the stress of this whole thing. His family had to sell all this acreage that they had for defense lawyer fees.
He lost everything, and his family suffered.
See, in their mind, they were willing to do whatever it took to help Adam out. But that's a lot of pressure on him. You know, it doesn't matter that he had nothing to do with the crimes. It had everything to do with, where can I cut my losses? So when they offer him a plea deal, which is felony assault, and you can walk out, well, he takes the felony assault charge and walks out of court, because the felony assault charge carries a sentence that is shorter than the sentence he's already served.
But at this time, that former sheriff's deputy, Mike Brown, when asked about the investigation, says, sloppy isn't the word. It stinks, and it warrants an investigation. This is the guy that literally investigated the case and then wasn't included. The judge said, the presence of DNA evidence, a confession, a motive, a connection to the deceased, and all of that was missing in his trial. And none of that fit the bill for him. This was a nightmare.
That judge apologized to Adam. I think the great thing here is we find that when certain prosecutors or law enforcement officers, not all of them, but some, will double down on their beliefs no matter what evidence has come to light, there are other judges and law enforcement officers who do care. And I like how this judge went out of his way to say, I apologize, because he wants Adam to trust the system. You know, it didn't work right for a while, but they got there in the end. And he's saying, hey, I'm a judge and I care. I care what happened to you, and it should never have happened. So for people who feel like there's no trust in the system, it's only as good as the people in it. And depending on which court you're in, or which law enforcement agency you're dealing with, or which detective you're dealing with, it could be anywhere. You could have a great system, or you could have a system that worked as poorly as this one did.
The system makes mistakes. We know this. It's okay. I think we have one of the better systems in the world, but it's how we handle those mistakes that makes it better or worse. And in this case, they were definitely making it worse along the way. They couldn't get the facts straight. You would think an appeals panel would know which sergeant was actually at the crime scene. But the reports, I'm assuming, were doctored because they just assumed Troy Brown was the guy, and they just started changing things.
So it was early August 2019 when Adam got to go home.
This is just a few months ago.
Yeah, essentially.
That sucks.
Again, there are theories about what happened here, about what actually happened to Malcolm Burrows, about why law enforcement did what they did, why the prosecution carried this case based only on eyewitness testimony, which it's fair to say in a lot of places they wouldn't have done this. I think a lot of courtrooms wouldn't have gone through with this trial. Now, I'm sure some of you will say, trust me, there will be some because they'll try their swing at it. All they have to do is convince a jury. And what's more powerful than a victim speaking? But I think you can look at it on the face of it and say, there was this description of a young man, close-cropped red hair, driving a gold car. That fits Adam Brazil. It also fits Kermit Bryson. But as law enforcement said, all along, even after the fingerprint was ID'd, Kermit Bryson was never on our radar. So maybe they have a point. They're just doing their jobs, right?
Yeah, they didn't put him on the photo lineup to be picked out, nor did the family ever say that wasn't the guy.
But here's the problem. When you have powerful testimony by Mike Brown, who had worked this case, who had been there, who found Malcolm Burrows' body at close to 11:30 at night. And this is in direct response to being questioned, like, why does your testimony not line up with the records? He's looking at them and saying, these appear to be doctored. And when you add up all the information about how certain things weren't entered into evidence, other records just disappeared, this goes beyond they got it wrong.
We have a special guest for this episode that we think you might want to hear from. Who did you get to talk to, Aaron?
Well, I had been in contact with Adam Brazil, and he said, well, what do you need? And I said, more like, what do you need? You know, I mean, when you hear the story about what happened to him and how this case just went completely bonkers and everybody doubled down on their mistakes or their errors or their on-purpose errors, however you want to say it, what did he have to say? One of the things I wanted to ask him about was his family, because he lost his wife early on. And you'll hear it in his own words. He said that she was his best friend. Imagine losing your best friend slash wife when she knows you're innocent, you know you're innocent, and yet you're being carried along and you're looking at over 50 years in prison. This is a current that he couldn't get out of. And his idea was, hey, if I didn't do anything wrong, but as we know, this system, once it grabs a hold of you, it wants to chew you up and swallow you. So I spoke with Adam at length, and what follows is my interview with Adam Brazil.
Aaron.
Hello, Adam.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm doing wonderful. I try to do great every day. I say when people ask me, you know, having the best day of my life, you better know I'm having the best day of my life out here, huh?
Now you know just how much it counts, right?
Yeah, it's so easy to take things for granted.
Obviously, I read about your case. I mean, I'm sure in your head, there's not really much similarity between you and this other gentleman. But from an outsider's point of view, if you just read the description of the person, man, you can totally see why someone would pick you up. And that's just the kind of thing in life where you can't prepare yourself for that.
I hear you loud and clear, but if you know the case even more, it wasn't even that simple. Yes, there's similarities, but what's interesting is that how my name got brought up in all this. We talked to an officer just recently. He came in and he's been instrumental in this case. He's the reason I was able to get a writ of error quorum nobis. You know, he provided newly discovered evidence. And not only did he blow the motive out of the water, they said that I went and killed this man over his wallet. Well, guess what? Lo and behold, this officer come forward just recently and said, no, no, no. When he found the dead man's body, he found the wallet on him. So the wallet should have been in evidence. It wasn't, which means that they stole the dead man's wallet to set me up. And then he also offered information regarding how my name got brought up in this. And so, Aaron, listen to this carefully. My name got brought into this because he did his job. He simply said, asked one of his informants, do you know a redheaded man? And this lady said, yes, I do. And his name's Adam Brazil, and he lives in Pelham, and he's real religious. I used to go to church with him. And that's how my name got brought up. He took that information to the corrupt Sheriff Myers, and Sheriff Myers set this case up around me using that information.
So he didn't know you, but this was just to close the case.
The sheriff definitely wanted the case closed, and he did not want the truth to come out. It would have made Grundy look even worse than it already did. And then there's some ties with him and the pharmacies and this guy, Malcolm Burrows, and his evil doings, if you will. And so it makes sense. What better man to pick out than someone that doesn't know anything about the case, which is me, that fits the description. And so I was the perfect man to set up, if you will. If that's sad to say, but it's so true.
Let's take this back. Can you tell us a bit about what your life was growing up?
You know, I live in a small town. It's Pelham, Tennessee, and it's beautiful. I live up in a cove. We're surrounded by mountains. You know, my dad got out of the Army and purchased this land, and we had about 115 acres. Grew up on a farm, two chicken houses, two hog houses, and roughly 60 head of cattle. Had three sisters. I'm the only boy. It was a great childhood. Mother and father, been married, my whole life. Then my dad passed away when I was 14 years old, which was detrimental. You know, mom went through a rough time. My sisters had moved out. They were in Chattanooga, which is not too far from here. And, you know, racing quads. And we got a bunch of beautiful land surrounding, you know, where I'm from here, and you can get on a trail and never get on the same trail and see waterfalls and bluffs, and it's beautiful. And so I did a lot of that growing up.
Could I get the names of your parents and siblings?
C.L. Brazil. I'm a Jean Brazil. That was my mother and my father. And my three sisters are from the oldest to the youngest is Susan Brazil, Brenda Brazil, and Christina Brazil.
You had a pretty tight-knit family because you said you had a great life growing up.
I did have a great life growing up. My three sisters moved away to Chattanooga, but we've always stayed in contact and been extremely close.
And your father, did he have some influence in how you've turned out? Is he a strong figure in your life?
My dad's always been that humble man that had the best interest of others in mind always. Of, you know, that father figure, that difference maker in my life.
Did he have a disease, or what happened to your father?
And my dad died of a rare blood disease. It killed him in less than a year. I'm not sure the name of it. Yes, sadly, that's what happened, my friend. Again, it goes back to showing us how vulnerable we are in life. It doesn't matter who we are. You never know what's around the corner. I was 24 years old. This all happened, and so I'd been with, my fiance forever, and when this all happened, we ended up getting married, not thinking that, you know, here I am actually innocent. You know, we didn't even consider them convicted me. We were trusting the justice system, and I basically, you know, go to prison and for a crime I knew nothing about. There I am, and, you know, my journey begins. Adverse situation, and it was either sink or swim, and I'm saying, hey, what sense does it make to let the bad choices of others ruin our life? And I knew that I had a choice, and so I capitalized on making good choices to, you know, live each day like there's no tomorrow. You know, really apply myself to grow, and as I did, I went through all these adversities, growing from them all, and then I had the unique opportunity to help others. So here we are now. Long story made short.
You said at the time when there was this investigation going on, you don't even know about it.
Yes, sir.
And so, at what point, like timeline wise, do you actually get married? And let's just start there. When does that happen in relation to this case that's slowly coming up towards you and is about to swallow you?
Okay, so they arrest me. When they arrest me, I get bonded out. And when I'm bonded out, me and my wife, she ended up moving into a place. We'd already, you know, been engaged for a while. So we went ahead and you know, made that leap. And we were best friends. And we'd done everything together. And so we got married. It was right after I was arrested, which is crazy to consider, because it wasn't even thought about. You know, we didn't even think about it. The potential outcome wasn't even discussed, never thought about it one time, just absolutely knew that everything would work out because I'm completely innocent. And that wasn't the case.
So this boiled down to, you knew what you wanted in life. You wanted to marry your best friend. And what's her name?
Sarah Tiffany Brazil.
You also knew that in order for you to be convicted and sent away to prison, they would need evidence, right? That's what you knew in your head.
Yes, sir.
I mean, we won't go into it just yet, but you've since found out you don't actually need evidence to send someone to prison.
No, you do not, sadly.
So you got married. Was it important to you, I guess, to get married before you moved in together?
Definitely. You know, we, you know, spiritually minded, wanted to do the right thing. And, you know, we made that choice. I was working at UPS as well. I would have topped out at $29 an hour. You know, life was going great. I was excited, you know, about life and, having, you know, creating a family, and, you know, all that was ripped from me.
Where were you when you found out, and what were you doing when you were finally picked up and you knew, wait a minute, this is really a problem now?
So January the 6th, that was Saturday night. January 7th was Sunday night. And the murder had occurred Saturday night. And so me and my buddies, we were out four-wheeling. And we come back that day, that later that night, Sunday night. And we were at Josh's mom, Josh Seagrove's my buddy. We pull up and we get out, go into the house, and his mom says, Malcolm Burrows has been killed. And it was sad at first, but then she said, Adam, they think you had something to do with it, or something along those lines. And so she said something about calling my mom. I needed to check my voicemail. My phone was dead. So I got on somebody's phone and I checked my voicemail, and my mom was like, she was frantic. Adam, call me. And then it got worse and worse and worse. And so, I ended up calling, and she told me to stay where I was, and she flew up to the mountain because she was afraid if the cops got to me first that they would kill me. And I didn't even pick up on what she meant, but there's been a lot of talk I've learned recently of how corrupt some officers can be. They can take you out potentially, and then it's a closed case. You know, if there's nothing you can do about it, they can say anything they want to say. And so my mom was frantic about getting to me before something happened to me. And she was worried about the law doing something to me. And so, you know, we hung out there, and then Josh, I will never forget his words. Josh said, Adam, man, it's all going to be okay. It's all going to work out. And that was comforting words. It really wasn't, you know, I didn't understand the severity And I didn't. I never did until I was convicted and I was in prison. And then I was able to process everything, what had just happened. But I had no idea, you know, the severity of the situation I was in.
Because you just can't imagine that you have anything to do with what they're talking about. I mean, why are they even bothering you?
You know, in this case, not only did I not do it, but I didn't even know anything about it. And so to be completely, actually innocent, I didn't think I had anything to worry about.
Okay, so what happened next for you then?
Continued to live my life. I bonded out, and we got married. So roughly 2 years go by, and then there's the court date, the trial. And I'm excited. We're going to go on vacation afterwards, like to Gatlinburg. And here we go. It didn't go the way I thought it would go, that I trusted it would go. So I go to county jail, and I'm smashed. You know, I'm flat on my back. I'm so depressed and discouraged, overwhelmed, anxiety. I can't breathe. I had no idea what to do. I realized how vulnerable I was at that moment. You know, how out of control, you know, how I had no control over the situation. An experience I'll never forget, to have my physical freedom taken from me. I speak about it often. About one thing I remember of many is that I seen the TV, you know, sometime the next day or something, and it advertised a commercial for food, fast food. And I knew at that moment that things were different, because I'd never been in jail a day in my life until all this. And then here I am in jail for the first time ever in my life, convicted of a murder I knew nothing about. At the time, I didn't know I had 51 years over my head. I had no idea. I had no idea that a murder charge carried 51 years. I had no idea about nothing. I was so unlearned. And that may be one of the reasons they capitalized on me as well. But when I seen that commercial, I knew, Aaron, that things were drastically different.
It's at that moment when many people lose all hope. They feel broken because they, like you said, you lose all control. You feel like your life's being steered and you're not at the wheel anymore.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I've always been outgoing and, you know, backflips off bridges or cliffs and racing four wheelers, you know, kind of fearless, if you will, 10 feet tall and bulletproof. And then for this to happen and for me to realize, you know, I have no control over this situation, it wasn't a good feeling. You know, now it's helped me. But at that moment, it's despair. It's overwhelming amounts of anxiety, depression, your mind going crazy. No control over the mind, my mind at that time. It was a sad situation that I was in. I even thought about killing myself.
That's really tough to hear, but I mean, I can sympathize. Just knowing how good everything was for you, and then have something come that you know does not apply to you but can ruin your life, it has to be just the worst feeling. To lose everything is just, it's just something that no one can be prepared for.
I mean, I like to challenge myself and you know, kind of go deep sometimes. And I think we can prepare for it. But at the same time, we can never experience it until it happens to us, if you will. We can prepare our minds to realize how vulnerable we are. And I look at adversities now as blessings in disguise, because when you and I, when we all face, and we all face them, adversities, there are opportunities for us to grow from. You know, anytime we're challenged, we can step out of our comfort zone. Indeed, it's uncomfortable, but we have the opportunity to grow, you know, and therefore, when I face adversities, when we all face adversities, I think we can look at them as blessings in disguise. The severity of the situation, not knowing if I would ever come home again, is something that's hard to imagine. Most people say that there's no way, Adam, I could have done that. I reply back with, I didn't think I could either. And so I know that we don't have to go through that kind of situation to grow or to learn, to prepare ourselves. I didn't have to go through that to grow in all the ways I have. It's just that, you know, I didn't capitalize on the freedom to choose. I didn't consider adversities as a blessing in disguise. I wasn't spiritually minded. You know, I didn't have that perspective. You know, I think it's important for us. And, you know, hindsight's 20/20, if you will. I can't go back and apply what I've learned now, but I can take what I'm learning and tell others about it, and then potentially they can. And that's what I look forward to doing for the rest of my life. I got a story to tell. You know, not everybody can say they've been an innocent man in prison with 51 years over their head, not knowing if they would ever come home. Not everybody can say that they had the best days of their life, you know, choosing to grow from all they went through, you know, making the best of every day, looking for opportunities not only to grow, but to help others grow, and then to see it all come together. And so many people the world over fight for you or for me, and to be able to come home and enjoy life. And now I'm able to capitalize on, you know, what I asked others to do. I beg people, Aaron, step out of your comfort zone, get involved. It wasn't comfortable for people to get involved in this case. It's a scary case. And so people did step out of their comfort zone. People did get involved. They didn't compromise for confrontation. It's still going on. People are still doing this, which is incredibly humbling. And so now that I'm home, Aaron, it's my turn to give back. How dare me to turn my back on other people that are in the same situation I'm in. And so I'm excited to keep telling my story and trying to motivate people to have a good perspective in life, a correct perspective, to see things for what they really are. And I believe that adversities in life, the challenges that we all face, all of us, can be looked at as a blessing in disguise, considering all the good that can come from being challenged.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
Now, when you were in prison,
yeah,
you must have had some support. People who reached out to you, you know, just checking on you, letting you know they missed you, that kind of thing. What kind of support did you get while you were in prison?
Oh, man, I'm so glad you asked this question. So there was this one time at South Central that I wrote on a sticky note, and I put on that sticky note, kind of drawed a little square in the middle of it, and it was a picture of me. I didn't draw the picture of me, but I wrote picture of me. And then on the top, I said, you know, who framed me, or I forget what it says. I still got it. And so it said, call this number with any information. I showed this to somebody, and somebody I was working with. I was working in the library. He was a legal assistant. I really confided in this man, and he told me, he said, Adam, nobody cares. And I think he was trying to prepare me, even though that hurt me when I heard that. Mm-hmm. And I told him, I said, if I care the way I do, then I know there's other people out there that care. And I started writing down on college rule paper, everybody that sent me a letter, a card. And I ended up coming out of there after 9 years, because you do know that I was freed. The judge overturned my case on Christmas Day. He overturned my case on Christmas Day. I come out justly free, and was free for 10 months. They appealed it, won the appeal, and brought me back. So anyways, after 9 years, I was justly free. And I had that those pages where people, I saved every letter, every card, every piece of mail I got. I still got it all the 12 years I've been down. I had in mind that when I come out, I want to take a piece of mail every day or at least once a week, go through it and write people back or call them. I've not done that yet, my friend, but I still got them all. And it's been incredibly humbling. I got a warrior sister, though, that I want to talk about. She sacrificed her life for me. So if, you know, all these people that we're talking about, man, that's really, you know, that's made a big difference in my life. If it wasn't for Christina, these people wouldn't have got involved because they would have never known about the case. She didn't have to. Sadly, my wife didn't get involved. You know, she did at first, but it was so overwhelming. She didn't make the choice to, you know, fight the fight. She went another direction. And that's always sad to talk about, but my sister, she did. She fought this fight. She sacrificed her life for me, my friend. And fear, whoever killed this man was out here all alone. Whoever had a part in setting me up, they had power. And she knew it. We knew it. I told her, don't even work on my case unless you're faithful to God. But she continued to fight for me every which way you can imagine. She did not eat lunch. She would eat peanuts and beef jerky and wouldn't go to lunch. Saved every penny she could, paid weekly on attorney bills. She was in the trenches. She was with a shovel, you know, just digging away, doing anything and everything that she knew how, knew to do. And people got involved because of her. She put it out there on the internet, you know, and this one guy, DK Sales, got involved and started a blog and got a lot of attention. And it just continued to grow. People genuinely care about people. And especially when people are making the right choices. And that's one thing, you know, about this case. There's no skeletons in my closet. I'm completely innocent. I've been taken advantage of. And it makes people mad. And they care enough to want to try to help. And sometimes people can't help monetarily, but they can. And it's just offering a prayer or sending a letter. And they did. And so, you know, I call her my superrific warrior sister. And she has. She's sacrificed everything for me. And I'm so thankful to have the family that I have. You know, it's not just Christina. I've got the other two sisters that's been there. And my mama, you know, my mom's been really sick, but she's my number one supporter. She's did what she knew how to try to help. And not everybody in my family, Aaron, has got the perspective I have as far as this has all been, you know, a blessing in disguise. My mom, she said something that was out of anger last night. It still bothers my family. It bothers me, you know, that I'm justly free with a felony, that we still owe $60,000 on top of the $200,000 that we've already paid for attorneys to fight to prove I'm an innocent man. The truth came out that I'm completely innocent, and yet the DA saved face. They wanted to make a deal and offer this Alford's plea, guaranteed I'd come home that day, you know, drop the murder charge, all that. It's everybody knew the DA. They knew I was innocent, but they didn't want to take responsibility for their actions. They knew that I was the wrong man. They knew I was completely innocent in prison. And that's why they threw that deal out there the way they did. Many deals. And then it come back to, I've done 12 years. So they can't just turn me loose in their mind. They had to, you know, they gave me this Alford's plea for an assault. They took the murder charge off the table. And they're saying, in their own words, they know I'm innocent because they say whoever killed Malcolm assaults Becky. And so for them to take the murder charge off the table, they're telling the world they know that I'm innocent. They believe it. But it's in their best interest to offer this deal, like it was in my best interest to take it, because there was no guarantee I would ever come home again. The first time I was an innocent man, and look what happened. And then I got out, and then they ended up appealing it, winning the appeal, overturning my judge's decision. So there was too many uncertainties. You know, the next day, I won't forget. I thought, man, I regret taking the deal. Everything was coming together. The truth had come out. I regretted it. But then I thought, I put myself back off into my shoes that I was in the day before, 51 years over my head, not knowing if I'd ever come home. And I knew that, man, I'd made the right choice. I was home. You shouldn't have to pay for the wrongdoings of others. And nor should we. The state, rather, is the ones that should have to pay for our attorneys, should have to compensate me. I shouldn't have a felony. And that's what disturbed my mom last night. We were all talking about it. And I was sad that she didn't necessarily, you know, have that perspective that I have. But I get it. And you get it. We get it. But it can make you bitter and furious that these people have been able to get away with such a horrible, you know, this is a travesty of justice. And it's not just me and my family. We got the judge. We got the sheriff. We got officers of the law. We got jurors. We got the majority of the majority. I'm talking about the communities all around. They support me. They, you know, he messaged me on Messenger this morning. We become friends on Facebook, and just talking about the enormous impact that I've had in their life because of my choices. And they're so sorry for what's taken place.
You said they appealed. They got you put back in prison.
Once I got brought back to prison after I was released justly free for 10 months without a felony record, they had appealed. I want to throw this in there because I think this is crazy. I'm no paralegal. I'm no lawyer. I'm no expert or nothing, but this just does not make sense to me. So I was released based on ineffective assistance of counsel. Here I am justly free, and they appeal it, the state. They win this appeal. One of the reasons they won the appeal was based on this information that the Court of Criminal Appeals handed down, their opinion. There was an impermissibly suggestive identification. This witness is on the stand, and he says it was the first photograph that he's seen. It was a single photograph. That's in the transcripts. And anybody that knows anything about the law knows that's an impermissibly suggestive identification. There's no getting around it. He literally said, the witness, that it was a single photograph and it was the first one he's seen. That's illegal. That's illegal. So the Court of Criminal Appeals, they overturned my judge's decision to free me, an innocent man, on this issue here. They said he was shown many photographs. So you keep reading the transcripts. And he later comes back to say he was shown many photographs. So, in other words, the Court of Criminal Appeals said, well, because he was shown many photographs, this is not impermissibly suggestive identification. And I'm saying, hey, correct me if I'm wrong, but yes, it is. Because no matter how many photographs he saw after he was shown out of his own mouth a single photograph, and it was the first one he seen, it's an impermissibly suggestive. So I went back to prison on a technical issue, and I was there for 3 years, not knowing if I'd ever come home again, 51 years over my head. A big deal was that we got a lot of support from the community, from the world, and it got out there. Well, this officer heard about it through this website called DK Sales, the Adam Brazil case. So when he heard about it, he's the one that found the body, by the way. He said, well, I need to testify or anything. No, we got this. He's an upstanding, respected officer, man of integrity. They didn't want him to have nothing to do with this case because you know what was going down. They were setting me up, and we got proof. We got tons of proof. Well, this officer found out that they had used this wallet to set me up. And I told you earlier that he come forward with this information after he found that out, that no, sir, Mr. Brazil could not have killed Malcolm over his wallet, because when he found that wallet on Malcolm Burroughs, this officer, Mike Brown, Sergeant Mike Brown, he found the wallet on him. That come about, and we filed a writ of habeas corpus along with a habeas corpus. Once this habeas corpus was in, it went back before this incredible just judge angel. Here we go. A juror comes forward. She states, she never voted guilty. She never raised her hand. She never signed anything. She was bullied by the foreman of the jury. She says she believed I was innocent then, believes I'm innocent now. She's so sorry. And then we find out that they're out of nowhere. The TBI agency, they get involved and retest a fingerprint that was found inside the car, passenger door, with the man that's dead laying beside it. So, and the story is that this suspect comes, lures the man out of the house, and so they're riding in the car together, and he's supposed to kill him in the woods. His fingerprint, this guy's fingerprint, found inside the car, passenger door, there was never a conclusion to whose fingerprint it was. the TBI agency retests this fingerprint out of nowhere, and lo and behold, there's a match. It belongs to Kermit Bryson, and Kermit Bryson's killed a cop before. Kermit Bryson has ties with his family. His girlfriend has a son that is Malcolm, the man that was murdered's grandson. He fits the description to a T. You were talking about it earlier. Drives a gold-colored car. His fingerprint was found inside the car, passenger door, with the dead man laying beside it. That right there was the smoking gun. The TBI agency literally undermined the state's case. They saved my life. You know, amongst many other people got involved, you know, has a big part to play in this, but they withheld that fingerprint for 15 months. That's unacceptable.
It's disgusting.
And why didn't it is, it really is. You know, in law enforcement, there's good and bad officers. There's good and bad judges, DAs, good and bad DAs. In the TBI agency, FBI, you know, you name it, there's good and bad. Justice system is not a bad system. We're blessed to have the justice system. It's just the people in it. There's a lot of people that are corrupt. And in my case, it's a landmark case as far as, you know, the opportunity to dive in deep and to see the corruption involved. And there's been a lot of corrupt individuals that's made bad choices in my case. And, you know, I'm not going to snoop to their level, man. And I'm so thankful for just judges and officers and jurors. And I'm still even hopeful for the DA to come around. You know, there's always a chance to say, you know, I take responsibility for my actions, admit that, you know, we made mistakes. I'm still hopeful. But I'm so thankful for the TBI agency, in my case, you know, for them to go back in and retest that fingerprint, and for them to talk about it on the stand. And it really made a big difference for sure. And that's one of the reasons why when she got up on the stand, you know, the DA, they went to squirming and trying to save face, throw them deals out at me. They knew it was going down because they offered me a deal the day before court. And it was going to be 5 more years, Alpert's plea, and you go home. I'd always said, I'll never take a deal. I don't know what influenced me way back when. I must have seen a Dateline or something. I don't remember what it was, but I said, I'll never take a deal. I knew a little bit about Alpert's pleas, and I was disgusted that they even offered me that kind of deal. And that night, I went and talked to my buddies, and I got buddies that got life without parole. I got buddies that are innocent, and some were saying, Adam, take the deal, go home, take the deal and go home. And I was like, no, absolutely not. I've got a battle to fight. I'm going to fight this battle. It's a worthy cause. I might be in here the rest of my life, an innocent man. But then when it got thrown in my lap, it kind of changed some things, called home, and I cried my eyeballs out. I cried like never before, and was telling my sissy, you know, my sister about it, and just really confused. And the next day we got court, and I come out, and I don't know if you've seen any of the videos, but man, the whole courtroom is jam packed full. They won't allow anybody else in there. Everybody's standing. They shout out, you know, and celebrate me coming in, and you know, their support. And oh wow! And then here we go. You know, my attorneys, they're prepared, and they say, kick back and enjoy the show. And so I kind of, so to speak, kicked back, and here we go. And they did an amazing job. Everything come together. The DA started squirming, run back to the back room, and started throwing these deals out there. They brought me in there, and they offered me this one deal and then another deal, and I'm saying no to everything. And we talked to some people that, you know, I talked to one guy, Jason Strong, that was in prison, completely innocent, exonerated by the Innocence Project. I called him in there. We talked, and, you know, I had my mentors, my spiritual mentors come in, and we all thought, you know, well, my attorneys, they said, you know, Adam, can you do more good in here or out there? And I think that weighed, I think that was a, you know, a big deal right there to contemplate that. And then he said, you know, do you want a family? Because if you fight this fight, you may not have the opportunity to have a family, you know, and you're guaranteed to go home. They want you to go home today. And, I hated the idea that I would go home with a felony. I knew an Alford's plea was a best interest plea and that you don't have to, I would never admit guilt to something I knew nothing about. You know, I've been in there the rest of my life, an innocent man. If they said, here, go home and you got to plead guilty, I would have never done it. But for me to be able to take an Alford's plea, everybody knows I'm innocent. And for me to be able to go home, and I thought I could go home without a felony, but it didn't work out that way. I'd done 12 years and they wasn't going to let me go home with the assault. And so I ended up going home justly free with a felony, which is crazy. But I'm home and we're still fighting this fight, man. It's continuing on. We got a lot going for us. We're going to the governor. And, you know, an exoneration, that word exonerate is designed, created for people just like me, completely innocent, actually innocent. And it's when the justice system fails an individual, such as in my case. And so this governor is he is known for being a great, great guy. And so if things have worked out, come together thus far, I'll continue to make good choices and be hopeful. And we're extremely hopeful that this governor will exonerate me.
Is this like a decision where, say, a president at the end of the term?
Somebody brought that up. I think it was yesterday, actually. And they asked the same question. And I said, no, not to my knowledge. I'm under the impression that he can make this decision anytime he wants.
Oh, I'm sure that's true. Sometimes politicians wait until their term's up and they're leaving office to do things because they don't want the judgment to continue if they continue on in that office. But feel free to tell me what's actually going on.
In my mind, and I'm just little old Adam, you know, anywhere I go, I have tons and tons of people come up to me. Glory to God. I'm so thankful and so humbling. People support me on Facebook, social media, you know, the media, whether it's out of Chattanooga, whether local here, Nashville, you know, the media is for me. You know, everybody knows that I'm completely innocent and has been railroaded. So he's a politician at the end of the day. But he's still, you know, he's a man of God. Yeah, he could wait to the end of the term. Yeah, I really have no idea. I'm in the dark as far as what his decision will be and when he'll make it. But I'm hopeful. You know, I'm hopeful that things will continue to work out and that at the end of the day, I'm justly free without a felony. It'll be a sense of complete. It'll be to a certain extent, a complete justice, which I think complete justice will be if I'm exonerated. And then whoever did this is held accountable. It's sad that Malcolm, this man, he was murdered. That's horrible. And that family has suffered. And he's a victim. They're victims. But also, me and my family are victims as well. If I don't receive an exoneration and the case is not opened, I'll even throw compensation in there. We all know that if I'm completely innocent, then we've paid out over $200,000 in attorneys. We still owe $60,000. I lost my job at UPS, would have topped out at $29 an hour. Lost my wife, my life to a certain extent. I will say that this is something that I want to pursue in the future, and that's for the DAs to be held accountable. You know, there needs to be laws implemented because they're beyond reproach right now. You know, in New York, there was a law just recently passed where DAs are held accountable. That's something, a safeguard, you know, something that needs to take place because they shouldn't be beyond reproach. And there should be some way to hold them accountable, even if they don't want to hold themselves accountable when we have the evidence, like in my case or like in Mario's case. Not everybody knows about this that's going on, but because of my case, I'm learning. People say it all the time. Until it happened to you, Adam, until I learned I got involved in your case, I did not know these things were going on. So we can't apply something we don't know. And I think it's up to us to kind of speak out and try to inform, educate, and motivate people to get involved because it can happen to you. You know, and that's why I'm thankful, man. I'm thankful for you and what you're doing. You know, this is not comfortable for me to speak out. This is not my cup of tea, but the more I do it, the more I'm involved, the more educated I become, the more I'm going to grow. And the more I realize I have the opportunity to more effectively help others.
And you will. I can just tell, you know, you say you're uncomfortable, but you're passionate. And that will see you through, I believe, because you're driven. You're not going to say, well, I don't feel like doing it today. You'll keep doing it because you know the value of what you have. You have this experience. Is there anywhere that you could suggest people go if they want to follow you, hear more about you, or just get involved more?
Well, there's a couple of things. Obviously, I need help. We need help, my sister and I. We networked in the Innocence community. People are making a big difference in our lives, but we still need help. We need help, learning more so that we can do more. But right now, we're trying to raise the $60,000 that we still owe for the attorneys. I've been going around door to door, literally, after all I've been through, asking for donations. We had a big fundraiser just the other day, Saturday. Very successful. A lot of people come out and didn't raise a lot of money. We raised like $4,000, which was we're very grateful. A lot of work went into that, though. A lot of work. And we need help trying to raise this money, this $60,000.
Do you have anything online, like a GoFundMe or anything?
My Facebook page, obviously, and then there's a Help Exonerate Adam Brazil, and then there's the Fear of the Hills or the Adam Brazil case.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.